The parable of the talents in Matthew 25 has always left me a little uneasy. For one thing, parables by intent are meant to end with a question mark, leaving their audience with an anxious and counterintuitive decision that they'd rather not face and can't quite pin down anyway. And yet, in this parable, the answer seems pretty clear. Put our God-given talents to use. In fact, this is so widely accepted that the word talent itself came into the English language as a reference to our God-given gifts because of this parable. It was transformed from its ancient use as a word for a standard measure of great wealth. So from that point alone, I'm curious as to whether the traditional interpretation that we've probably all heard in many sermons is actually in line with the intent of Matthew's gospel, or Jesus' intent for that matter. Increasing my unease is this. Jesus is the social revolutionary, at least in progressive churches. He's constantly campaigning against the evils of privilege and position and power. And yet, in this story, the person who already holds position and power seems to be eager to acquire even more through the efforts of others, and engages with his servants in ways that would have been perceived by the original audience as unfair and dishonest. But let's take a look at the setting to begin with. It is part of a very clear and intentional sequence of events in the Gospel of Matthew, all of which focus on the issue of the return of Christ. In chapter 23, a couple chapters earlier, Jesus preaches to the crowds for the last time, strongly condemning the hypocrisy of the scribes and Pharisees, all those woes. Then in chapter 24, as he leaves the temple, he prophesies that it will be destroyed and begins talking with his disciples about what will happen when the end times come, ending with a warning for them to be ever vigilant for the return of the Son of Man. And now in chapter 25, Matthew presents us with three stories in a row that illustrate what being vigilant means in this context. The first story, the parable of the 10 virgins, tells us we must always be prepared for the coming of Christ. The second is this morning's reading, the parable of the talents. And the third is the story about the separation of the sheep and goats, where we learn, and I'll paraphrase a bit, that just as we are nourished, and just as you nourished or clothed the least of your fellow human beings, you did the same for the Christ. All three of these stories are told in private to his immediate disciples, not to the crowds. And after he's finished, at the start of chapter 26, Jesus says, "You know that after 2 days the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified." And then comes that distressing set of events, the Last Supper, Judas Iscariot's betrayal, the arrest and the trial, and finally the crucifixion. Now, all three of these parables tell us something about what we are called to do while waiting for the return of Christ. The first tale covers what we should do while we wait. Always be prepared. The second, according to the classical interpretation, tells us to not just sit around and wait, but to actively use what we've been given. And finally, the third tells us that we are to minister to the needs of our fellow human beings, no matter how low their estate. Okay, all well and good. Many a sermon has been preached using this lens, and it's hard to argue anything other than this view is what the author of Matthew intended to convey. But as we all know, when we skim through a scripture thinking we know what it's telling us, we miss those little details that, once examined, opened up new vistas and revelations about our faith and about our individual journeys with God. You know, I kind of feel for that third slave. In the parable, the master entrusts him with a talent, which was a fortune in those days. It was equal to 70 pounds of silver. Now, silver in today's world is around 20 bucks an ounce, so that would have been around $20,000 or so. But back then, a talent was a standard unit of currency that was more or less equivalent to the expected gross earnings of a day laborer over a 20-year period. If we use that measure and take our present minimum wage of 8 bucks an hour or 64 bucks a day as a day laborer's wages, then a talent was worth around $400,000 in today's money. That's quite a bit. The parable tells us that this man is very cautious with what he's been entrusted with, maybe even wise. Fearing the master's wrath, he buries the talent, which back then was considered the best way to prevent theft. In fact, according to Jewish custom of the time, as recorded in the Mishnah, which is one of the great catalogs of Jewish tradition, if that money had been stolen after it was buried, the slave would not have been held responsible. because it was recognized as the safest way to preserve wealth. We also need to remember that banks were not safe back then. There was no Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So bank failures were always a risk. Therefore, the master's admonition that the slave should have invested it in a bank for the interest is really unfair. And even more than it seems, since Jewish scriptures forbid usury or the charging of interest. Why then would the master say that at the very least this is what the slave should have done? According to Jewish custom and the common wisdom of the time, the man had done everything right. So what's the problem? The guy was prudent. He didn't play games with the master's money, and he didn't do anything that would have risked loss of that money, and yet he's the bad guy. The worthless slave who'll be thrown into the outer darkness where there is miserable mourning and great fear. The master isn't being remotely reasonable. Why? But I think that's precisely the point. Faith is not a safe thing. At its heart, Christianity is always challenging the existing social order and mindsets, no matter whether we're talking about back then or today, whether we're talking about pagans and idols or our own church. It's about challenging ourselves, moving to new places, learning new perspectives, seeing more deeply, having more compassion, being filled with more love. Faith is about becoming a vibrant, growing, fulfilled, productive child of God, rather than some static, lifeless creature. A living faith is difficult and even scary because it means doing what isn't safe, setting aside the known and launching into that which is unknown. Growth cannot occur without change. Faith is indeed a risky business. And frankly, as far as I know, every religion, certainly every major one, emphasizes that the taking of risks is an important factor in achieving spiritual growth. The Buddha, for instance, took a risk when he walked away from his position as a royal prince to become a monk. The Prophet Muhammad took a risk fleeing Mecca to take refuge in Medina. The pilgrims took a risk in seeking a new land far from their original home. And what is now the Church of the Latter-day Saints made the risky decision to follow Brigham Young across the Great Plains to found Salt Lake City in 1847. And even today, in the lives of people like Sue Kyi, Malala Yousafzai, that young girl who was shot in Pakistan, and Pope Francis, we see a drive to constantly take risky actions and speak risky words, challenging where we are with their faith and their passion for a better future for all. So here's the heart of the problem. Our ever-so-prudent third slave is not acting in faith. Yes, he's acting prudently, cautiously, maybe even wisely. That's not faith. He's grasping for a risk-free solution in a very risky world and will never find it. This is because risk is an essential aspect of life and faith. You can't avoid it and you can't bury it. Faith tells us this, that certainty is found only in God. It embraces change rather than providing false assurances that the boat will never be rocked again. Now, the film we'll be showing after the service today, Divided We Fall, Americans in the Aftermath, falls in line with this theme. Back in early September of 2001, Valerie Kaur was the granddaughter of Sikh immigrants who'd arrived in California a century ago. She was a third-generation American, preparing to return to college after summer break. And then came 9/11. Valerie was already very aware of the ongoing instances of discrimination against her people in this country. And it got much worse after 9/11, even though Sikhs are not Muslims, and espouse a faith that advocates peace, tolerance, and justice for all, not terrorism. Worse still, to even identify a Sikh as a Muslim must be painful for a Sikh to hear, because they've been the target of centuries of Islamic oppression and genocide. And so Valerie was faced with a dilemma. Her family has been in this country for a century, about as long as my dad's family, actually. And yet people were yelling at her and her people saying, "You don't belong here. Go back home where you belong, you terrorist." But she does belong here. She's an American. This is her home, always has been and always will be. She didn't see herself as anything but as American as you or I. And yet people were saying she wasn't. How could this be? And so she took a risk. A big one. Even though she knew nothing about journalism or filmmaking and had seen very little of the world outside of California, she took a leave from school to set out on a journey across a country, driving to New York City and Ground Zero to begin a journey of months and eventually years that led to the creation of that documentary. To, as she says at the beginning of her film, discover what it means to be American. In so doing, she came to a much deeper and more profound understanding of who she is as an American, as a Sikh, and what being a Sikh and an American means to her. This certainly wasn't a prudent thing to do. I'm sure her parents worried a great deal for her safety. She could have gone on with her studies, losing herself in academia until the crisis was over, perhaps studying it from a distance, as she had been, maybe even getting herself better prepared for some future journey in this area. But instead, she chose to act now and to open up her heart, to hear the stories of many of her fellow Sikhs and those who were oppressing them, to understand their stories, Sikh and bigot alike, and how they are part of her story, and how their stories, together with yours and mine, are part of the American story. As I said a little bit ago, she did not lose herself, as she could have easily done, and as the third slave did. Instead, she found herself. And that's where our third slave failed. In being prudent and cautious, he stagnated. Learned nothing about himself or what he was called to do. He did not succeed because he dared not risk failure. He did not grow because he was afraid. He did not thrive because he refused to take any risk at all, and so he stayed in the place he'd always been. He did not learn what his talents were or what he could do with them. He was good only at protecting himself and guarding what he already had until called to account for it. In the end, he lost and was lost because he was unwilling to risk losing. And for me, that's what this parable is really about. Not about using whatever your talents are, but rather about not letting fear keep you from giving it a shot. In fact, the whole message of being open and affirming boils down to almost the same thing. Take a risk. Leave our positions of comfort and safety and stability. Reach out to embrace someone who we're not totally sure if they're safe or not. Someone who's different. And then hearing and learning their story, learning to appreciate them for who they are. Learning what it is that makes them unique, amazing, precious people. Learning that their story is part of ours too, and that all of our stories together are part of the story of our infinite, amazing, and still speaking God. In closing, I wanted to add one thing, which just came into the news this past Friday, which was the sponsoring of the first ever Muslim prayer at the National Cathedral in Washington. Did you guys see that in the news? Never happened before. The National Cathedral is not government-owned or driven, separation of church and state, obviously, but it is run by the Episcopalians, and it dedicates itself to fostering religious understanding and faith in society, in our country as a whole. It's a beautiful building. It was just completed about 20 years ago, I think. They spent over a century building it. But they had never invited Muslims into the church before. There had never been a Muslim prayer service there before. And so, in doing so, this very act of inviting those of a faith we've long battled to worship inside that church, a church some have called a national treasure, is an enactment of this parable. We're not to hide our treasure, but to put it to use, to take risks with it. Now, some will certainly object to this, and they certainly did that day. There was a woman who broke into the middle of the service and tried to shut it down. And I could quote a few dozen scriptures to counter the many who online so vehemently condemned this opportunity for Muslims to pray in the cathedral, but then I'd be judging them. On the other hand, I already am. So I think I'll just say it's best to merely say that in a world where we seem to so often be more concerned about what divides us than what unites us, particularly in cities like Washington, D.C., this effort by the National Cathedral to reach across that gap between faiths is an affirmation that there is hope, that we will someday look at our neighbor and see them just as God does, as simply another child of the Creator, like we are, and just as beloved. Many of these others, these strange worshipers from another faith, have sacrificed just as much as any normal American has for this country. They are as American as we are and deserve to be welcomed as such, even if we find their embrace a little uncomfortable. A little risky, maybe even, perhaps, the first time. Yes, faith is a very risky business indeed. Amen. for the song.